Though I had corresponded with Deborah since Clive first became ill, it was only 20 years later that I met Clive in person, and he was so changed from the haunted, agonized man I had seen in Miller's 1986 film that I was scarcely prepared for the dapper, bubbling figure who opened the door when Deborah and I went to visit him in the summer of 2005. He had been reminded of our visit just before we arrived, and he flung his arms around Deborah the moment she entered. Deborah introduced me. "This is Dr. Sachs." And Clive immediately said, "You doctors work 24 hours a day, don't you? You're always in demand." We went up to his room, which contained an electric organ console and a piano, piled high with music. Some of the scores, I noted, were transcriptions of Orlandus Lassus, the Renaissance composer whose works Clive had edited. I saw Clive's journal by the washstand. He has now filled up scores of volumes, and the current one is always kept in this exact location. Next to it was an etymological dictionary with dozens of reference slips of different colours stuck between the pages, and a large, handsome volume, The 100 Most Beautiful Cathedrals in the World. A Canaletto print hung on the wall, and I asked Clive if he had ever been to Venice. "No," he said, but Deborah told me they had visited several times before his illness. Looking at the print, Clive pointed out the dome of a church. "Look at it," he said. "See how it soars, like an angel." When I asked Deborah whether Clive knew about her memoir, she told me that she had shown it to him twice before, but that he had instantly forgotten. I had my own heavily annotated copy with me, and asked Deborah to show it to him again. "You've written a book," he cried, astonished. "Well done, congratulations." He peered at the cover. "All by you. Good heavens." Excited, he jumped for joy. Deborah showed him the dedication page. "For my Clive." "Dedicated to me." He hugged her. This scene was repeated several times within a few minutes, with almost exactly the same astonishment, the same expressions of delight and joy each time. Clive and Deborah are still very much in love with each other, despite his amnesia. Indeed, the subtitle of Deborah's book is A Memoir of Love and Amnesia. He greeted her several times, as if she had just arrived. It must be an extraordinary situation, I thought, both maddening and flattering, to be seen always as new, as a gift, a blessing. Clive had, in the meantime, addressed me as Your Highness, and inquired at intervals, "Been at Buckingham Palace? Are you the Prime Minister? Are you from the UN? He laughed when I answered, "Just the US. This joking or jesting was of a somewhat waggish, stereotyped nature and highly repetitive. Clive had no idea who I was, little idea who anyone was, but this bonhomie allowed him to make contact, to keep a conversation going. I suspected he had some damage to his frontal lobes, too. Such jokiness. Neurologists speak here of Witzelsucht, joking disease, like his impulsiveness and his incontinent chattiness, could go with a weakening of the usual social frontal lobe inhibitions. He was excited at the notion of going out for lunch with Deborah. "Isn't she a wonderful woman?" he kept asking me. "Doesn't she have marvelous kisses?" I said yes, I was sure she had. As we drove to the restaurant, Clive, with great speed and fluency, invented words for the letters on the license plates of passing cars. J.C.K. was Japanese clever kid, N.K.R. was new king of Russia, and B.D.H., Deborah's car, was British Daft Hospital, then Blessed Dutch Hospital. Forever Today, Deborah's book, immediately became Three Ever Today, Two Ever Today, One Ever Today. This incontinent punning and rhyming and clanging was virtually instantaneous, occurring with a speed no normal person could match. It resembled Touretic or savant-like speed, the speed of the preconscious, undelayed by reflection. When we arrived at the restaurant, Clive did all the license plates in the parking lot, and then, elaborately, with a bow and a flourish, let Deborah enter. "Ladies first." He looked at me with some uncertainty as I followed them to the table. "Are you joining us too?" When I offered him the wine list, he looked it over and exclaimed, "Good God! Australian wine! New Zealand wine! The colonies are producing something original. How exciting!" This partly indicated his retrograde amnesia. He is still in the 1960s, if he is anywhere, when Australian and New Zealand wines were almost unheard of in England. The colonies, however, was part of his compulsive waggery and parody. At lunch he talked about Cambridge. He had been at Clare College, but had often gone next door to King's for their famous choir. He spoke of how, after Cambridge, in 1968, he joined the London Sinfonietta, where they played modern music, though he was already attracted to the Renaissance and Lassus. He was the chorus master there, and he reminisced that singers could not talk during coffee breaks. They had to save their voices. It was often misunderstood by the instrumentalists, seemed standoffish to them. These all sounded like genuine memories, but they could, equally, have reflected his knowing about these events, rather than actual memories of them, expressions of semantic memory, rather than event or episodic memory. Then he spoke of the Second World War. He was born in 1938, and how they would go to bomb shelters and play chess or cards there. He said that he remembered the doodlebugs. There were more bombs in Birmingham than in London. Was it possible that these were genuine memories? He would only have been 6 or 7 at most. Or was he confabulating, or simply, as we all do, repeating stories he had been told as a child? At one point, he talked about pollution and how dirty petrol engines were. When I told him I had a hybrid with an electric motor as well as a combustion engine, he was astounded, as if something he had read about as a theoretical possibility had, far sooner than he had imagined, become a reality. In her remarkable book, so tender, yet so tough-minded and realistic, Deborah wrote about the change which had so struck me, that Clive was now garrulous and outgoing, could talk the hind legs off a donkey. There were certain themes he tended to stick to, she said, favourite subjects, electricity, tube, stars and planets, Queen Victoria, words and etymologies, which would all be brought up again and again. "Have they found life on Mars yet?" "No, darling, but they think there might have been water." "Really? Isn't it amazing that the sun goes on burning? Where does it get all that fuel? It doesn't get any smaller, and it doesn't move. We move round the sun. How can it keep on burning for millions of years? And the Earth stays the same temperature. It's so finely balanced." "They say it's getting warmer now, love. They call it global warming." "No. Why's that?" "Because of the pollution. We've been emitting gases into the atmosphere and puncturing the ozone layer."
"Oh, no. That could be disastrous.
People are already getting more cancers."
"Oh, aren't people stupid? Do you know the average IQ is only 100? That's terribly low, isn't it? 100! It's no wonder the world's in such a mess."
"Cleverness isn't everything."
"Well, no.
It's better to be good-hearted than clever."
"Yes, you've got a point.
And you don't have to be clever to be wise."
"No, that's true."
Clive's scripts were repeated with great frequency, sometimes 3 or 4 times in one phone call. He stuck to subjects he felt he knew something about, where he would be on safe ground, even if here and there something apocryphal crept in. These small areas of repartee acted as stepping stones on which he could move through the present. They enabled him to engage with others. I would put it even more strongly, and use a phrase that Deborah used in another connection when she wrote of Clive being poised upon a tiny platform above the abyss. Clive's loquacity His almost compulsive need to talk and keep conversations going served to maintain a precarious platform, and when he came to a stop, the abyss was there, waiting to engulf him. This indeed is what happened when we went to a supermarket, and he got separated briefly from Deborah. He suddenly exclaimed, "I'm conscious now. Never saw a human being before. For 30 years. It's like death." He looked very angry and distressed. Deborah said the staff calls these grim monologues his deads. They make a note of how many he has in a day or a week, and gauge his state of mind by their number. Deborah thinks that repetition has slightly dulled the very real pain that goes with this agonized but stereotyped complaint, but when he says such things, she will distract him immediately. Once she has done this, there seems to be no lingering mood, an advantage of his amnesia. And, indeed, once we were back in the car, Clive was off on his license plates again. Back in his room, I spotted the two volumes of Bach's 48 Preludes and Fugues on top of the piano, and asked Clive if he would play one of them. He said that he had never played any of them before, but then he played Prelude 9 in E major and said, as he played, "I remember this one." He remembers almost nothing unless he is actually doing it. Then it may come to him. He inserted a tiny, charming improvisation at one point and did a sort of Chico Marx ending with a huge downward scale. With his great musicality and his playfulness, he can easily improvise, joke, play with any piece of music. His eye fell on the book about cathedrals, and he talked about cathedral bells. Did I know how many combinations there could be with 8 bells? 8 by 7 by 6 by 5 by 4 by 3 by 2 by 1, he rattled off. Factorial 8. And then, without pause, "That's 40,000. I worked it out laboriously. It is 40,320. I asked him about prime ministers. Tony Blair? Never heard of him. John Major? No. Margaret Thatcher? Vaguely familiar. Harold Macmillan? Harold Wilson? Ditto. But earlier in the day, he had seen a car with JMV plates and instantly said, "John Major vehicle," showing that he had an implicit memory of Major's name. Deborah wrote of how he could not remember her name, but one day someone asked him to say his full name, and he said, "Clive David Deborah Waring." Funny name, that. I don't know why my parents called me that. He has gained other implicit memories too, slowly picking up new knowledge, like the layout of his residence. He can go alone now to the bathroom, the dining room, the kitchen, but if he stops and thinks en route, he is lost. Though he could not describe his residence, Deborah tells me that he unclasps his seat belt as they draw near and offers to get out and open the gate. Later, when he makes her coffee, he knows where the cups, the milk, and the sugar are kept. He cannot say where they are, but he can go to them. He has actions but few facts at his disposal. I decided to widen the testing and asked Clive to tell me the names of all the composers he knew. He said, "Handel, Bach, Beethoven, Berg, Mozart, Lassus." That was it. Deborah told me that at first, when asked this question, he would omit Lassus, his favourite composer. This seemed appalling for someone who had been not only a musician, but an encyclopedic musicologist. Perhaps it reflected the shortness of his attention and recent immediate memory. Perhaps he thought that he had in fact given us dozens of names. So I asked him other questions on a variety of topics that he would have been knowledgeable about in his earlier days. Again, there was a paucity of information in his replies, and sometimes something close to a blank. I started to feel that I had been beguiled, in a sense, by Clive's easy, nonchalant, fluent conversation into thinking that he still had a great deal of general information at his disposal, despite the loss of memory for events. Given his intelligence, ingenuity, and humour, it was easy to think this on meeting him for the first time, But repeated conversations rapidly exposed the limits of his knowledge. As Deborah writes in her book, Clive stuck to subjects he knew something about and used these islands of knowledge as stepping stones in his conversation. Clearly, Clive's general knowledge or semantic memory was greatly affected too, though not as catastrophically as his episodic memory. Yet semantic memory of this sort, even if completely intact, is not of much use in the absence of explicit episodic memory. Clive is safe enough in the confines of his residence, for instance, but he would be hopelessly lost if he were to go out alone. Lawrence Weisskrantz comments on the need for both sorts of memory in his book Consciousness Lost and Found. The amnesic patient can think about material in the immediate present. He can also think about items in his semantic memory, his general knowledge. But thinking for successful everyday adaptation requires not only factual knowledge, but the ability to recall it on the right occasion, to relate it to other occasions, indeed, the ability to reminisce. This uselessness of semantic memory unaccompanied by episodic memory is also brought out by Umberto Eco in his novel The Mysterious Flame of Queen Loana, where the narrator, an antiquarian bookseller and polymath, is a man of Eco-like intelligence and erudition. Though amnesic from a stroke, he retains the poetry he has read, the many languages he knows, his encyclopedic memory of facts, but he is nonetheless helpless and disoriented, and recovers from this only because the effects of his stroke are transient. It is similar, in a way, with Clive. His semantic memory, while of little help in organizing his life, does have a crucial social role. It allows him to engage in conversation, though it is occasionally more monologue than conversation. Thus, Deborah wrote, he would string all his subjects together in a row, and the other person simply needed to nod or mumble. By moving rapidly from one thought to another, Clive managed to secure a sort of continuity, to hold the thread of consciousness and attention intact, albeit precariously, for the thoughts were held together on the whole by superficial associations. Clive's verbosity made him a little odd, a little too much at times, but it was highly adaptive. It enabled him to re-enter the world of human discourse. In the 1986 BBC film, Deborah quoted Proust's description of Swan waking in a strange room, not knowing at first where he was, who he was, what he was. He had only the most rudimentary sense of existence, such as may lurk and flicker in the depths of an animal's consciousness, until memory came back to him, like a rope let down from heaven to draw me up out of the abyss of not-being, from which I could never have escaped by myself. This gave him back his personal consciousness and identity. No rope from heaven, no autobiographical memory will ever come down in this way to Clive. From the start, there have been, for Clive, two realities of immense importance. The first of these is Deborah, whose presence and love for him have made life tolerable, at least intermittently, in the 20 or more years since his illness. Clive's amnesia not only destroyed his ability to retain new memories, it deleted almost all of his earlier memories, including those of the years when he met and fell in love with Deborah. He told Deborah, when she questioned him, that he had never heard of John Lennon or John F. Kennedy. Though he always recognized his own children, Deborah told me, he would be surprised at their height and amazed to hear he is a grandfather. He asked his younger son what O-level exams he was doing in 2005, more than 20 years after Edmund left school. Yet somehow he always recognized Deborah as his wife when she visited and felt moored by her presence, lost without her. He would rush to the door when he heard her voice and embrace her with passionate, desperate fervor. Having no idea how long she had been away, since anything not in his immediate field of perception and attention would be lost, forgotten, within seconds, he seemed to feel that she, too, had been lost in the abyss of time, and so her return from the abyss seemed nothing short of miraculous. Clive was constantly surrounded by strangers in a strange place, Deborah wrote, with no knowledge of where he was or what had happened to him. To catch sight of me was always a massive relief, to know that he was not alone, that I still cared, that I loved him, that I was there. Clive was terrified all the time, but I was his life, I was his lifeline. Every time he saw me, he would run to me, fall on me, sobbing, clinging. How, why, when he recognized no one else with any consistency, did Clive recognize Deborah? There are clearly many sorts of memory, and emotional memory is one of the deepest and least understood. Neil J. Cohen has written about the famous experiment of Edouard Claparède, a Swiss physician, in 1911. Upon shaking hands with a patient with Korsakoff syndrome, the condition which caused my patient Jimmy's severe amnesia, Claparède pricked her finger with a pin hidden in his hand. Subsequently, whenever he again attempted to shake the patient's hand, she promptly withdrew it. When he questioned her about this behavior, she replied, "Isn't it allowed to withdraw one's hand? And perhaps there is a pin hidden in your hand." And finally, "Sometimes pins are hidden in hands." Thus the patient learned the appropriate response based on previous experience, but she never seemed to attribute her behavior to the personal memory of some previously experienced event. For Claparède's patient, some sort of memory of the pain, an implicit and emotional memory, persisted. It seems certain, likewise, that in the first 2 years of life, even though one retains no explicit memories, Freud called this infantile amnesia, deep emotional memories or associations are nevertheless being made in the limbic system and other regions of the brain where emotions are represented. And these emotional memories may determine one's behavior for a lifetime. And a recent paper by Oliver Turnbull et al. Has shown that patients with amnesia can form emotional transferences to an analyst, even though they retain no explicit memory of the analyst or their previous meetings. Nevertheless, a strong emotional bond begins to develop. Clive and Deborah were newly married at the time of his encephalitis, and deeply in love for a few years before that. His passionate relationship with Deborah, a relationship that began before his encephalitis, and one that centers in part on their shared love for music, has engraved itself in him, in areas of his brain unaffected by the encephalitis, so deeply that his amnesia, the most severe amnesia ever recorded, cannot eradicate it. Nonetheless, for many years he failed to recognize Deborah if she chanced to walk past, and even now he cannot say what she looks like unless he is actually looking at her. Her appearance, her voice, her scent, the way they behave with each other, and the intensity of their emotions and interactions, all this confirms her identity and his own. The other miracle was the discovery Deborah made early on, while Clive was still in the hospital, desperately confused and disoriented, that his musical powers were totally intact. "I picked up some music," Deborah wrote, "and held it open for Clive to see. I started to sing one of the lines. He picked up the tenor lines and sang with me. A bar or so in, I suddenly realized what was happening. He could still read music. He was singing. His talk might be a jumble no one could understand, but his brain was still capable of music. I could hardly wait to get back to the ward and share this news. When he got to the end of the line, I hugged him and kissed him all over his face. Clive could sit down at the organ and play with both hands on the keyboard, changing stops and with his feet on the pedals, as if this were easier than riding a bicycle. Suddenly we had a place to be together, where we could create our own world away from the ward. Our friends came in to sing. I left a pile of music by the bed, and visitors brought other pieces." Miller's film showed dramatically the virtually perfect preservation of Clive's musical powers and memory. In these scenes, from only a year or so after his illness, his face often appeared tight with torment and bewilderment. But when he was conducting his old choir, he did this with great sensitivity and grace, mouthing the melodies, turning to different singers and sections of the choir, cueing them, encouraging them to bring out their special parts. It is obvious that Clive not only knew the piece perfectly, how all the parts contributed to the unfolding of the musical thought, but also retained all the special skills of conducting, his professional persona, and his own unique style. Clive cannot retain any memory of passing events and experience, and, in addition, has lost most of the memories of events and experiences preceding his encephalitis. How, then, does he retain his remarkable knowledge of music, his ability to sight-read, to play the piano and organ, sing, conduct a choir, in the masterly way he did before he became ill? H.M., a famous and unfortunate patient described by Scoville and Milner in 1957, was rendered amnesic by the surgical removal of both hippocampi, along with adjacent structures of the medial temporal lobes. This was considered at the time the best treatment for his intractable seizures. It was not yet realized that autobiographic memory and the ability to form new memories of events depended on these structures. Yet H.M., though he lost many memories of his former life, had not lost any of the skills he had acquired, and indeed he could learn and perfect new skills with training and practice, even though he would retain no memory of the practice sessions. Larry Squire, a neuroscientist who has spent a lifetime exploring mechanisms of memory and amnesia, emphasizes that no two cases of amnesia are the same. He wrote to me, "If the damage is limited to the medial temporal lobe, then one expects an impairment such as H.M. had. With somewhat more extensive medial temporal lobe damage, one can expect something more severe, as in E.P. This is a patient whom Squire and his colleagues have investigated intensively. With the addition of frontal damage, perhaps one begins to understand Clive's impairment, or perhaps one needs lateral temporal damage as well, or basal forebrain damage. Clive's case is unique, and not like H.M., or like Claparède's patient, because a particular pattern of anatomical damage occurred. We cannot write about amnesia as if it were a single entity, like mumps or measles. Yet H.M.'s case made it clear that two very different sorts of memory could exist: a conscious memory of events, episodic memory, and an unconscious memory for procedures, and that such procedural memory is unimpaired in amnesia. This is dramatically clear with Clive, too, for he can shave, shower, look after his toilet, and dress elegantly, with taste and style. He moves confidently and is fond of dancing. He talks fluently and abundantly, using a large vocabulary. He can read and write in several languages. He is good at calculation. He can make phone calls, and he can find the coffee things and find his way about the home. If he is asked how to do these things, he cannot say, but he does them. Whatever involves a sequence or pattern of action, he does fluently, unhesitatingly. An extraordinary but not uncommon condition, first recognized in the 1960s, is transient global amnesia, or TGA, an amnesia that lasts only a few hours, but may be very severe. It has never been clear what causes TGAs, but they are more common in middle-aged and elderly patients, and sometimes occur in the course of a migraine. There is often only a single attack in a lifetime. Such a transient amnesia may come on at any time, with effects that can be comic or alarming. My niece, Carolyn Bierstead, a physician in England, told me of a patient of hers, an ardent fisherman, who had longed for years to catch a giant trout in a nearby stream. By a bizarre coincidence, he had an attack of TGA while he was fishing one day. It did not impair his skills in the least, and he caught the trout. But catching it, the absolute peak of his fishing life, left no trace in his mind, and no memory of it was ever retrieved. When shown photographs of himself cradling the prize fish in his arms, he did not know whether to laugh or cry. A more alarming story was related to me by the neurologist Harold Clowans about a colleague of his, a general surgeon, who became amnesic towards the end of a gallbladder operation. He became uncertain, confused, repetitive. "Did I remove the gallbladder?" he asked repeatedly. "What am I doing? Where am I?" The nurse who was assisting him wondered if he had had a stroke, but, seeing that his surgical skill was unimpaired, despite a profound memory impairment, kept him going by handing him the sutures one by one, and so, with her help, he closed the abdomen successfully. While he was himself again in a few hours, he never recovered any memory of the operation he had performed. Clowans subsequently published a description of this incident and of his own careful examination of the surgeon while still amnesic. But can Clive's beautiful playing and singing, his masterly conducting, his powers of improvisation, be adequately characterized as skills or procedure? For his playing is infused with intelligence and feeling, with a sensitive attunement to the musical structure, the composer's style and mind. Can any artistic or creative performance of this caliber be adequately explained by procedural memory? Episodic or explicit memory, we know, develops relatively late in childhood and is dependent on a complex brain system involving the hippocampi and temporal lobe structures, the system that is compromised in severe amnesiacs and all but obliterated in Clive. The basis of procedural or implicit memory is less easy to define, but it certainly involves larger and more primitive parts of the brain, subcortical structures like the basal ganglia and cerebellum, and their many connections to each other and to the cerebral cortex. The size and variety of these systems guarantees the robustness of procedural memory and the fact that, unlike episodic memory, procedural memory can remain largely intact, even in the face of extensive damage to the hippocampi and cerebral cortex. Episodic memory depends on the perception of particular and often unique events, and one's memories of such events, like one's original perception of them, are not only highly individual, coloured by one's interests, concerns, and values, but prone to be revised or recategorized every time they are recalled. This is in fundamental contrast to procedural memory, where it is all important that the remembering be literal, exact, and reproducible. Repetition and rehearsal, timing and sequence, are of the essence here. Rodolfo Linus, the neurophysiologist, uses the term fixed action patterns, FAPs, for such procedural memories. Some of these may be present even before birth. Fetal horses, for example, may gallop in the womb. Much of the early motor development of the child depends on learning and refining such procedures through play, imitation, trial and error, and incessant rehearsal. All of these start to develop long before the child can call on any explicit or episodic memories. Is the concept of fixed action patterns any more illuminating than that of procedural memories in relation to the enormously complex creative performances of a professional musician? In his book Eye of the Vortex, Linus writes, "When a soloist, such as Jascha Heifetz, plays with a symphony orchestra accompanying him, by convention the concerto is played purely from memory. Such playing implies that this highly specific motor pattern is stored somewhere and subsequently released at the time the curtain goes up. But for a performer," Linus writes, "it is not sufficient to have implicit memory only. One must have explicit memory as well." Without intact, explicit memory, Jascha Heifetz would not remember from day to day which piece he had chosen to work on previously, or that he had ever worked on that piece before. Nor would he recall what he had accomplished the day before, or, by analysis of past experience, what particular problems in execution should be a focus of today's practice session. In fact, it would not occur to him to have a practice session at all. Without close direction from someone else, he would be effectively incapable of undertaking the process of learning any new piece, irrespective of his considerable technical skills. This, too, is very much the case with Clive, who, for all his musical powers, needs close direction from others. He needs someone to put the music before him, to get him into action, and to make sure that he learns and practices new pieces. What is the relationship of action patterns and procedural memories, which are associated with relatively primitive portions of the nervous system, to consciousness and sensibility, which depend on the cerebral cortex? Practice involves conscious application, monitoring what one is doing, bringing all one's intelligence and sensibility and values to bear, even though what is so painfully and consciously acquired may then become automatic, coded in motor patterns at a subcortical level. Each time Clive sings or plays the piano or conducts a choir, automatism comes to his aid. But what comes out in an artistic or creative performance, though it depends on automatisms, is anything but automatic. The actual performance reanimates him, engages him as a creative person. It becomes fresh and alive, and perhaps contains new improvisations or innovations. Once Clive starts playing, his momentum, as Deborah writes, will keep him and keep the piece going. Deborah, herself a musician, expresses this very precisely. The momentum of the music carried Clive from bar to bar. Within the structure of the piece, he was held, as if the staves were tramlines and there was only one way to go. He knew exactly where he was because in every phrase there is context implied by rhythm, key, melody. It was marvelous to be free. When the music stopped, Clive fell through to the lost place, but for those moments he was playing, he seemed normal. Clive's performance self seems, to those who know him, just as vivid and complete as it was before his illness. This mode of being, this self, is seemingly untouched by his amnesia, even though his autobiographical self, the self that depends on explicit episodic memories, is virtually lost. The rope that is let down from heaven for Clive comes not with recalling the past, as for Proust, but with performance, and it holds only as long as the performance lasts. Without performance, the thread is broken, and he is thrown back once again into the abyss. It was very similar for the amnesic narrator in Umberto Eco's novel The Mysterious Flame of Queen Loana. I started humming a tune to myself. It was automatic, like brushing my teeth. But once I began thinking about it, the song no longer came of its own accord, and I stopped on a single note. I held it a long time, at least 5 seconds, as if it were an alarm or dirge. I no longer knew how to go forward, and I didn't know how to go forward because I had lost what came before. While I was singing without thinking, I was actually myself for the duration of my memory, which in that case was what you might call throat memory, with the befores and afters linked together, and I was the complete song, and every time I began it, my vocal cords were already preparing to vibrate the sounds to come. I think a pianist works that way too. Even as he plays one note, he's readying his fingers to strike the keys that come next. Without the first notes, we won't make it to the last ones. We'll come untuned, and we'll succeed in getting from start to finish only if we somehow contain the entire song within us. I don't know the whole song anymore. I'm like a burning log. The log burns, but it has no awareness of having once been part of a whole trunk, nor any way to find out that it has been, or to know when it caught fire. So it burns up, and that's all. I'm living in pure loss. Eco's narrator may call it pure loss, but the wonder of it, in fact, is that it is pure gain. One can gain the whole song without any explicit memory, any memory in the usual sense. The song almost miraculously seems to create itself, note by note, coming from nowhere. And yet, somehow, as Eco puts it, we contain the entire song. Deborah speaks of the momentum of the music in its very structure. A piece of music is not a mere sequence of notes, but a tightly organized organic whole. Every bar, every phrase, arises organically from what preceded it and points to what will follow. Dynamism is built into the nature of melody, and over and above this, there is the intentionality of the composer, the style, the order, and the logic which he has created to express his musical ideas and feelings. These, too, are present in every bar and phrase. Marvin Minsky compares a sonata to a teacher or a lesson. No one remembers word for word all that was said in any lecture or played in any piece. But if you understood it once, you now own new networks of knowledge about each theme and how it changes and relates to others. Thus, no one could remember Beethoven's Fifth Symphony entire from a single hearing, but neither could one ever hear again those first four notes as just four notes. Once but a tiny scrap of sound, it is now a known thing, a locus in the web of all the other things we know, whose meanings and significances depend on each other. A piece of music will draw one in, teach one about its structure and secrets, whether one is listening consciously or not. This is so even if one has never heard a piece of music before. Listening to music is not a passive process, but intensely active, involving a stream of inferences, hypotheses, expectations, and anticipations, as David Huron and others have explored. We can grasp a new piece, how it is constructed, where it is going, what will come next, with such accuracy that even after a few bars we may be able to hum or sing along with it. Such anticipation, such singing along, is possible because one has knowledge, largely implicit, of musical rules, how a cadence must resolve, for instance, and a familiarity with particular musical conventions, the form of a sonata or the repetition of a theme. But anticipation is not possible with music from a very different culture or tradition, or if musical conventions are deliberately shattered. Jonah Lehrer, in his book Proust Was a Neuroscientist, discusses how Stravinsky did this famously with his Rite of Spring, whose first performance in 1913 caused a riot that required the Paris police to intervene. The audience, which had expected a traditional classical ballet, was enraged by Stravinsky's violation of the rules. But with time and repetition, the strange became familiar, and the Rite of Spring is now a beloved concert piece, as tame as a Beethoven minuet, though Beethoven, too, was hissed in his time, and some of his music regarded at first as unintelligible, mere noise. When we remember a melody, it plays in our mind. It becomes newly alive. There is not a process of recalling, imagining, assembling, recategorizing, recreating, as when one attempts to reconstruct or remember an event or a scene from the past. We recall one tone at a time, and each tone entirely fills our consciousness, yet simultaneously it relates to the whole. It is similar when we walk or run or swim. We do so one step, one stroke at a time, yet each step or stroke is an integral part of the whole, the kinetic melody of running or swimming. Indeed, if we think of each note or step too consciously, we may lose the thread, the motor melody. It may be that Clive, incapable of remembering or anticipating events because of his amnesia, is able to sing and play and conduct music, because remembering music is not, in the usual sense, remembering at all. Remembering music, listening to it or playing it, is entirely in the present. Victor Zukerkandl, a philosopher of music, explores this paradox beautifully in his book Sound and Symbol. The hearing of a melody is a hearing with the melody. It is even a condition of hearing melody that the tone present at the moment should fill consciousness entirely, that nothing should be remembered, nothing except it or beside it be present in consciousness. Hearing a melody is hearing, having heard, and being about to hear all at once. Every melody declares to us that the past can be there without being remembered, the future without being foreknown. It has been 20 years since Clive's illness, and for him, nothing has moved on. One might say he is still in 1985, or, given his retrograde amnesia, in 1965. In some ways, he is not anywhere at all. He has dropped out of space and time altogether. He no longer has any inner narrative. He is not leading a life in the sense that the rest of us do. And yet one has only to see him at the keyboard, or with Deborah, to feel that, at such times, he is himself again, and wholly alive. It is not the remembrance of things past, the wants that Clive yearns for, or can ever achieve. It is the claiming, the filling of the present, the now, and this is only possible when he is totally immersed in the successive moments of an act. It is the now that bridges the abyss. As Deborah recently wrote to me, Clive's at-homeness in music and in his love for me are where he transcends amnesia and finds continuum, not the linear fusion of moment after moment, nor based on any framework of autobiographical information, but where Clive and any of us are, finally, where we are, who we are. Chapter 16. Speech and Song. Aphasia and Music Therapy. Samuel S. developed severe expressive aphasia following a stroke in his late 60s, and he remained totally speechless, unable to retrieve a single word, despite intensive speech therapy 2 years later. The break for him came when Connie Tomeno, the music therapist at our hospital, heard him singing one day outside her clinic. He was singing Old Man River, very tunefully and with great feeling, but only getting 2 or 3 words of the song. Even though speech therapy had been given up with Samuel, who was by then regarded as hopeless, Connie felt that music therapy might be helpful. She started to meet with him 3 times a week for half-hour sessions, in which she would sing with him or accompany him on the accordion. Mr. S. was soon able, singing along with Connie, to get all the words of Old Man River, and then of many other ballads and songs he had learned growing up in the 1940s, and as he did this, he started to show the beginnings of speech. Within 2 months, he was making short but appropriate responses to questions. For instance, if one of us asked Mr. S. about his weekends at home, he could reply, "Had a great time," or "Saw the kids." Neurologists often refer to a speech area in the premotor zone of the brain's dominant, usually left, frontal lobe. Damage to a particular part of this, an area first identified by the French neurologist Paul Broca in 1862, whether from a degenerative disease, a stroke, or a brain injury, may produce expressive aphasia, a loss of spoken language. In 1873, Carl Wernicke had described a different speech area in the left temporal lobe. Damage to this area was apt to produce difficulty understanding speech, a receptive aphasia. It was also recognized, at much the same time, that brain damage could produce disturbances of musical expression or appreciation, amusias, and that while some patients might suffer from both an aphasia and an amusia, others would have aphasia without amusia. We are a linguistic species. We turn to language to express whatever we are thinking, and it is usually there for us instantly. But for those with aphasia, the inability to communicate verbally may be almost unbearably frustrating and isolating. To make matters worse, they are often treated by others as idiots, almost as non-persons, because they cannot speak. Much of this can change with the discovery that such patients can sing not only tunes but the words of operas, hymns, or songs. Suddenly their disability, their cut-offness, seems much less, and though singing is not propositional communication, it is a very basic existential communication. It not only says, "I am alive, I am here," but may express thoughts and feelings that cannot be expressed at this point by speech. Being able to sing words can be a great reassurance to such patients, showing them that their language capacities are not irretrievably lost, that the words are still in them somewhere, even though it may take music to bring them out. Speech itself is not just a succession of words in the proper order. It has inflections, intonations, tempo, rhythm, and melody. Language and music both depend on phonatory and articulatory mechanisms that are rudimentary in other primates, and both depend, for their appreciation, on distinctly human brain mechanisms dedicated to the analysis of complex, segmented, rapidly changing streams of sound. And yet there are major differences and some overlaps in the processing of speech and song in the brain. Patients with so-called non-fluent aphasia not only have an impairment of vocabulary and grammar, but have forgotten or lost the feeling of the rhythms and inflections of speech, hence the broken, unmusical, telegraphic style of their speech, to the extent that they still have any words available. It is such patients who, as a rule, do best with music therapy, and who feel most excited when they are able to sing lyrics, for in doing so, they discover not only that words are still available to them, but that the flow of speech is also accessible, though bound, apparently, to the flow of song. This may also be the case with a different form of aphasia, so-called dynamic aphasia, where it is not the structure of sentences that is affected, but the initiation of speech. Patients with dynamic aphasia may speak very sparingly, yet produce syntactically correct sentences on the rare occasions when they do speak. Jason Warren et al. Described how an elderly man with mild frontal lobe degeneration and extreme dynamic aphasia was nonetheless unimpaired in musical initiative. He played the piano, could read and write music, and took part in a weekly singing group. He was also able to recite, as Warren et al. Noted. He was able to read a passage chosen at random from the Torah, using the heightened intonation, distinct from both singing and ordinary reading, reserved for reading aloud. Many aphasic patients can get not only the words of songs, but can learn to repeat sequences or series, days of the week, months of the year, numerals, etc. They may be able to do this as a series, but not to disembed a particular item from the series. So, one of my patients, for instance, can recite all the months of the year in order. January, February, March, April, May. He knows what the current month is. But when I ask him, he cannot respond simply, April. Indeed, aphasics may be able to reproduce much more elaborate, familiar sequences, a prayer or lines from Shakespeare or an entire poem, but only as automated sequences. Such sequences unfold, once they are started, in much the same way as music does. Hewlings-Jackson long ago distinguished propositional speech from what he called, variously, emotional, ejaculate, or automatic speech, stressing that the latter could be preserved in aphasia, sometimes to a startling extent, even when the former was grossly impaired. Cursing is often cited as a dramatic form of automatic speech, but singing familiar lyrics can be seen as equally automatic. A person with aphasia may be able to sing or curse or recite a poem, but not to utter a propositional phrase. The question of whether singing has any use in the recovery of speech, then, can be formulated another way. Can language embedded in unconscious automatism be released for conscious propositional use? During the Second World War, A.R. Luria began to investigate the neural basis of speech and language, of different forms of aphasia, and of methods for restoring speech. His work was published in Russian in a massive monograph, Traumatic Aphasia, in 1947, and in a small, startling book, Restoration of Function After Brain Injury, in 1948, though neither was translated or known in the West until several decades later. Given an acute injury to the brain, such as he saw in the stroke patients or injured soldiers he studied, Luria emphasized there would always be two levels of disturbance. First, there was a core of tissue destruction, which was irreversible, and second, a larger surrounding area or penumbra of depressed or inhibited function, which under certain conditions he felt might be reversible. When one first meets a patient immediately after a stroke or head injury, One sees only the total effects of injury, paralysis, aphasia, or other disabilities. It is difficult to distinguish disabilities produced by anatomical damage from those produced by inhibition of the surrounding neural tissue. Time will show the difference in most patients, for inhibition tends to lift spontaneously, usually in a matter of weeks. But in some patients, for reasons that are still unclear, it does not. At this point, if not before, it is crucial to start therapy to promote what Luria called de-inhibition. Speech therapy may lead to de-inhibition, but it may sometimes fail. If it fails, one may wrongly assume that the patient's aphasia is due to permanent anatomical damage and is thus irreversible. But music therapy for some patients can succeed where conventional speech therapy has failed, as in the case of Samuel S. It may be that cortical areas previously inhibited but not destroyed can be de-inhibited, kick-started into action, by re-experiencing language, even if it is of a wholly automatic sort, language embedded in music. A very crucial aspect of speech or music therapy for the aphasic patient is the relationship between therapist and patient. Luria emphasized that the origin of speech was social, no less than neurological. It required the interaction of mother and child. It is likely that the same is true of song, and in this sense, music therapy for patients with aphasia is profoundly different from music therapy for a movement disorder like Parkinsonism. In Parkinsonism, it is the motor system which is being activated almost automatically by music, and a tape or CD in this limited sense can do as much as a therapist. But with speech disorders like aphasia, the therapist and her relationship with the patient, a relationship which involves not only musical and vocal interaction, but physical contact, gesture, imitation of movement, and prosody, is an essential part of the therapy. This intimate working together, this working in tandem, depends on mirror neurons throughout the brain, which enable the patient not only to imitate, but to incorporate the actions or abilities of others, as Rizzoletti et al. Have explored. The therapist not only provides support and an encouraging presence, but literally leads the patient into more and more complex forms of speech. With Samuel S., this involved drawing language out until he could sing all the words of Old Man River, then leading him on to sing a whole range of old songs, then, by the right sort of questions, drawing him into short, responsive phrases. Whether there is a chance of going beyond this, of restoring fluent narrative or propositional speech to patients with long-standing aphasia, remains an open question. Saying, "had a great time," or "saw the kids," may be as far as Samuel S. can go. It might be said that such verbal responses are modest, limited, and formulaic, but they do represent a radical advance from purely automatic speech, and they can have an enormous effect on the daily reality of an aphasic person's life, allowing a formerly mute and isolated person to re-enter a verbal world, a world he had seemingly lost forever. In 1973, Martin Albert and his colleagues in Boston described a form of music therapy they called melodic intonation therapy. Patients were taught to sing or intone short phrases. For example, "How are you today?" Then the musical elements of this were removed slowly until, in some cases, the patient regained the power to speak a little without the aid of intonation. One 67-year-old man, aphasic for 18 months, he could only produce meaningless grunts and had received 3 months of speech therapy without effect, started to produce words 2 days after beginning melodic intonation therapy. In 2 weeks, he had an effective vocabulary of 100 words, and at 6 weeks, he could carry on short, meaningful conversations. What is happening in the brain when melodic intonation or any type of music therapy works? Albert et al. Originally thought that it served to activate areas in the right hemisphere, areas homologous to Broca's area. Albert's close colleague, Norman Geschwind, had been fascinated by the way in which children could recover speech and language even after the removal of the entire left hemisphere of the brain. This was sometimes done in children with uncontrollable seizures. Such a recovery or reacquisition of language suggested to Geschwind that, though linguistic ability was generally associated with the left hemisphere, the right hemisphere also had linguistic potential and could take over language functions almost completely, at least in children. Albert and his colleagues thus felt, without clear evidence, that this might be the case, at least to some degree, even in aphasic adults, and that melodic intonation therapy, calling as it did upon right hemisphere musical skills, could help to develop this potential. Detailed imaging of patients undergoing melodic intonation therapy was not possible during the 1970s, and a 1996 PET scan study by Pascal Bellin et al. Seemed to show that there was no activation in the right hemisphere of such patients. They reported, moreover, that there was not only an inhibition of Broca's area in aphasic patients, but hyperactivity of a homologous area in the right hemisphere. We may call it, for convenience, the right Broca's area. This sustained hyperactivity on the right side exerts an active inhibiting action on the good Broca's area, which in its weakened state is powerless to resist. The challenge, then, is not only to stimulate the normal, left Broca's area, but to find a way to damp down the right Broca's area with its malignant hyperactivity. Singing and melodic intonation seem to do exactly this. By engaging the right hemisphere circuits in normal activity, they disengage them from pathological activity. This process has a certain self-sustaining momentum of its own, for as the left Broca's area is released from inhibition, it can exert a suppressant action on the right Broca's area. A vicious circle, in short, is replaced by a therapeutic one. There is some preliminary evidence that the same effect may be accomplished by using repetitive bursts of transcranial magnetic stimulation applied to the right Broca's area to suppress its hyperactivity. Paula Martin and her colleagues have recently tried this technique in 4 patients who have been intractably aphasic for more than 5 years. Though they need confirmation, Martin et al.'s results are promising and may lead, they propose, to a novel complementary treatment for aphasia. For various reasons, little research attention was paid during the 1980s and 1990s to melodic intonation therapy for people with severe, non-fluent Broca's aphasia, or to the mechanisms by which it might work. Nonetheless, music therapists continue to observe that, in many cases, such therapy could allow very significant improvement. Recent work by Gottfried Schlaug and his colleagues carefully documents the brain activity of 8 patients undergoing melodic intonation therapy. This involves 75 sessions of intensive therapy. All of these patients, Schlaug et al. Report, showed significant changes in speech output measures and in a right hemispheric frontotemporal network while repeating simple words, phrases, in the MRI scanner. Schlaug showed me a number of videos of such patients, and the change in their ability to speak was indeed striking. Initially, many were incapable even of responding clearly to the question, "What is your address?" Following melodic intonation therapy, they were able to reply much more easily to such questions, even offering additional details beyond those asked for. They had clearly achieved at least a measure of propositional speech. These changes, both behavioral and anatomical, were attained even several months after the course of treatment had ended. As Schlaug points out, the neural processes that underlie post-stroke language recovery remain largely unknown and thus have not been specifically targeted by most aphasia therapies. But melodic intonation therapy, at least, has been shown to be ideally suited for facilitating language recovery in non-fluent aphasic patients, particularly in those with large left hemisphere lesions, for whom the only route to recovery may be the engagement of right hemispheric language regions. We have become accustomed, in the last 20 years or so, to dramatic revelations of cortical plasticity. Auditory cortex, it has been shown, can be reallocated for visual processing in congenitally deaf people, and the visual cortex in blind people may be recruited for auditory and tactile functions. But perhaps even more remarkable is the notion that the right hemisphere, which in normal circumstances has only the most rudimentary linguistic capacities, can be turned into a reasonably efficient linguistic organ with less than 3 months of training, and that music is the key to this transformation. Chapter 17. Accidental Davening, Dyskinesia and Cantillation. Solomon R. was an intelligent middle-aged man with a dyskinesia, an unusual movement disorder which, in him, took the form of rhythmic pulsions of various sorts, forcible expulsions of breath, accompanied by loud phonations, and a synchronous contraction of abdominal and trunk muscles, causing his body to bow or rock with each expiration. Over the weeks that I saw him, there was a strange elaboration of this picture. The expiratory phonatory beat began to acquire a sort of melody, a repetitive sing-song to accompany it, and to this, in turn, was added a half-articulate murmuring quality, like the prosody of a soft, unintelligible language. With this and his now increasing bowing movement, Mr. R. seemed to be cantillating, praying, davening, as such murmuring, rhythmically motoric prayer is called by religious Jews. Indeed, a couple of weeks later, I was able to catch a number of Hebrew words, which seemed to confirm my impression. But when I asked Mr. R., he told me that though they were indeed Hebrew words, they made no sense. They were plucked out of the air, he said, as if to fill the prosodic and melodic demand of his dyskinesia. Random though the words were, this strange activity gave Mr. R. a deep satisfaction and allowed him to feel he was doing something, and not just the victim of a physical automatism. Wanting to document this extraordinary scene, I went one day to the hospital with my tape recorder. As soon as I entered, I could hear Mr. R. down the hall. Or so I thought, but when I entered the room, I found a Sabbath service in progress. The cantillation was coming not from my patient, but from the davening rabbi himself. With the rabbi, presumably, the rhythmic emphases of prayer had led to a sympathetic rhythmic movement of the body, but with Mr. R., it had happened the other way round. Not originally a man attracted to cantillation or prayer, he had now been drawn to this through the physiological accident of dyskinesia. Chapter 18. Come Together, Music and Tourette's Syndrome. John S., a young man with Tourette's syndrome, recently wrote to me describing the effect of music on his tics. Music is a huge part of my life. It can be both a blessing and a curse when it comes to ticking. It can send me into a state where I forget all about Tourette's, or it can bring on a surge of tics that is difficult to control or bear. He added that his tics were especially brought on by certain kinds of music heavy with rhythm, and that their frequency and intensity might be determined by music, accelerating or slowing along with the music's tempo. Reactions like this are very similar to those of Parkinsonian patients, who may find themselves forgetting their Parkinsonism, enjoying a delicious motor freedom with some kinds of music, but being driven or entrained by others. But while Tourette's may be considered, like Parkinsonism, a movement disorder, albeit of an explosive rather than an obstructive kind, it is much more. It has a mind of its own. Tourette's is impulsive, productive, where Parkinsonism is not. Sometimes this productivity is more or less confined to the production of simple tics or repetitive fixed movements, and this seems to be the case with John S. But for some people, it may assume an elaborate, phantasmagoric form, remarkable for its mimicry, antics, playfulness, inventions, and unexpected and sometimes surreal associations. People with this rarer, phantasmagoric form of Tourette's may show much more complex reactions to music. One such man, Sidney A., could have very extravagant reactions to music, as he did one day to a piece of Western music on the radio. He lurched, jerked, lunged, yelped, made faces, and gesticulated exuberantly, and above all, he mimed and mimicked. The music seemed to trigger a cascade of wild, mimetic representations of the tone, the tenor, the landscape of the music, and all the images and emotional reactions these provoked in him as he listened. This was not just an exacerbation of ticking, but an extraordinary Touretic representation of the music, a very personal expression of his sensibility and imagination, though dominated by Touretic exaggeration, parody, and impulsiveness. I was reminded of a description by Henri Meige and E. Feindel in their 1902 book, Tics and Their Treatment, of a man with Tourette's who showed, on occasion, a veritable debauch of absurd gesticulations, a wild muscular carnival. I thought of Sidney, sometimes, as a mimetic virtuoso, but this was not a mimesis under his control, and for all its brilliance, it always had a certain flavour of the convulsive and the excessive. And yet, on another occasion, when Sidney took up his guitar and sang an old ballad, there was no ticking at all, but a total immersion in or identification with the song and its mood. Extraordinary creative interactions can occur when someone with Tourette's performs as a musician. Ray G was a man strongly drawn to jazz who played drums in a band on the weekends. He was noted for his sudden and wild solos, which would often arise from a convulsive drum-hitting tick, but the tick could initiate a cascade of percussive speed and invention and elaboration. Ray is more fully described in Witty Ticky Ray, a chapter in The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Jazz, or rock, with its heavy beat and its freedom to improvise, may be especially attractive to a musical person with Tourette's, and I have known a number of brilliant Touretic musicians who are jazz artists, though I also know other musicians with Tourette's who are more drawn to the structure and rigour of classical music. David Aldridge, a professional jazz drummer, explored these themes in a memoir entitled Rhythm Man. I've been banging on car dashboards since I was 6 years old, following and flowing with the rhythm until it poured out of my ears. Rhythm and Tourette syndrome have been intertwined from the first day I found that drumming on a table could mask my jerky hand, leg, and neck movements. This newly found masking actually harnessed my unbounded energy, directing it into an orderly flow. This permission to explode let me tap into vast reservoirs of sounds and physical sensations, and I realized that my destiny lay clearly before me. I was to become a rhythm man. Aldridge relied on music frequently, both to mask his tics and to channel their explosive energy. I would learn to harness the enormous energy of Tourette syndrome and control it like a high-pressure fire hose. Harnessing his Tourette's and expressing himself in creative, unpredictable musical improvisations seemed to be deeply intertwined. The urge to play and the desire to release the endless tension of Tourette syndrome fed on each other like fuel on fire. For Aldridge, and perhaps for many with Tourette's, music was inseparably linked to movement and to sensation of all sorts. The attractions, the joys, and the therapeutic powers of drumming and drum circles are widely known in the Tourette's community. In New York recently, I took part in a drum circle organized by Matt Giordano, a gifted drummer with severe Tourette's. When he is not focused or engaged, Matt is in constant Touretic motion, and indeed, everyone in the room that day seemed to be ticking in their own time. I could see eruptions of tics, contagions of tics rippling around the 30-odd Tourettes there. But once the drum circle started, with Matt leading them, all the ticking disappeared within seconds. Suddenly there was synchronization, and they came together as a group, performing in the moment with the rhythm, as Matt puts it. Their Touretic energy, motor exuberance, playfulness and inventiveness, all drawn upon creatively and given expression in the music. Music here had a double power. First, to reconfigure brain activity and bring calm and focus to people who were sometimes distracted or preoccupied by incessant tics and impulses. And second, to promote a musical and social bonding with others, so that what began as a miscellany of isolated, often distressed, or self-conscious individuals almost instantly became a cohesive group with a single aim, a veritable drum orchestra under Matt's baton.